Yes.
Otherwise, you and your background.
Okay, good question. This is my 26th year here at Pepperdine. Prior to coming to Pepperdine, I taught at St. John's University in New York City, I think for 14 years. Prior to that, I worked as a financial analyst for the United States Trust Company of New York. My main interest has always been in economic theory and political philosophy. I got my doctorate at the New York University Graduate School of Business. My undergraduate degree is from Columbia University in New York. I attended the graduate seminar of Ludwig von Mises, the man whom I consider to be the outstanding economist of the 20th century, starting in my senior year in high school on through graduate school. I got my PhD under him. While there, I learned German and translated one of his important books in my sophomore year in college. I wrote a shorter book called The Government Against the Economy, dealing with price theory and price controls, which is incorporated as three chapters in this book. This book came out in November of 1996. It took me about 15 years to write. I developed it out of my lectures, mainly here at Pepperdine, in this class and or in the macro course, of which this is one, and the micro course. So the book represents a writing out of lectures. And these outline, these syllabus supplements represent largely my lecture notes, the basic framework of the lecture notes, and they serve as the outline for the book. I'm married. My wife and I live in Laguna Hills. And she's a clinical psychologist in private practice and also an attorney. Okay, anything else?
Yes. For the cover of your book, and some of the content in terms of this around capitalism, the cover resembles the cover of Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, you think the cover resembles Atlas Shrugged? Really? I never thought of that.
Yeah.
What's the similarity in the cover?
The design. The Atlas Shrugged and the anniversary of Rick Christian's designer. This is your, not a few hundred or a this is the cover.
Yeah.
The colors of print.
Now, which anniversary edition? When did it appear?
I don't know when it first appeared. I bought it maybe about 8 years ago.
Well, if it preceded my book, it's possible there was some subconscious connection. I wasn't aware of it. But since you mentioned Atlas Shrugged, I greatly admire the author of Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand, and I knew her personally for many years. I met her for the very first time when I was 17 years old. And then that was a stormy meeting. I think I described it in the preface. And then met her again shortly after the publication of Atlas Shrugged, which I thought was the greatest novel ever written. And I very much admire her philosophy of objectivism. And I have many references to her in the index. And so I would have to say I'm heavily influenced by her ideas. Her and von Mises are my two main intellectual influences. And then also the classical economists like Smith and Ricardo and Mises' teacher, von Bavarck. So, anything else? Yes, and you are?
Keith Wilson.
Keith Wilson? Yeah, okay.
Other than obviously your own published works, are you working with any outside companies in any financial or economic consulting work?
I've done a little bit occasionally, but I don't do very much of it.
No, not currently.
Not currently, no. And you see, what companies are interested in is what could they learn that could improve their ability to make a profit. And I don't think that that's what economics is fundamentally about. And economics has important principles relating to profit, but economists know much less about how to make money than businessmen do. In economics, one could have a proposition, well, buy cheap and sell dear, that's fine, but what is cheap and what will be dear? That you can't know as an economist. I think the main value of economics to business is in explaining to the general public and the society why businessmen should be left free to make money. Not to teach businessmen how to make money, they know that much better than economists do. But what they don't know is how to explain why the material self-interest of everybody lies with their having the freedom to make money. And that's something that sound economics can explain. That's its real value to business.
I have a follow-up guy.
No, I don't work with any political groups or agencies. I have a loose affiliation with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. I've lectured there. I write some articles that appear there every so often. But I don't have any affiliation with any political group. Yes?
My name is Bill, and this might be a more sensitive question, I guess.
Okay.
I was reading the Hazlitt assignment and also the book. Okay. It struck me that, speaking in general, the economic theory set forth as correct and not correct, fallacious. It seems as though they're contrary to our government's policy and intention and action. And how do you feel about that, as putting so much time and effort saying, look, this is clearly the way to look at short term and long term, mm-hmm. and yet it's not being done and hasn't been done for, I don't know.
Well, it depends which particular policies you're talking about. Now, obviously, there are many, many ideas on economic policy that I present which are contrary to what's being pursued, but not all, and not as many as in the past. For example, back in the 1970s, we had price controls, and they proved disastrous. And they were removed, and that represented a major improvement. It had some important tendency to reduce the maximum tax rates. That's been an important step in the right direction. Internationally, there's been the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Communist Bloc. That's a tremendous improvement. So there are some very major positive developments going on, and then there are some important negative ones going on, and often I do feel a lot of frustration.
I would think more through social policy in certain socialist, what I consider socialist, or a socialist mentality.
Yeah, there's a widespread socialist mentality, and I'm totally opposed to it, and that is often a source of frustration. Yes?
Did you meet Hazlitt?
Yes, I knew Henry Hazlitt, and sometimes he attended Mises' seminar.
Did you quote him in here in the first film?
Pardon me?
He reversed him in the book.
Oh, yeah. And he and Mises knew each other. And Hazlitt gave a very glowing blurb of my first book on the governance against the economy. So, anything else? And Hazlitt is someone I greatly admire. All right, well, let's turn now to the introduction to the economist's perspective, which is what the readings in Hazlitt were about. Hazlitt presents what he considers the essential lesson in economics. He says the art of economics consists of looking at things, looking at the effects of things, not just on those most directly and immediately affected, but on all groups, those indirectly affected as well as those directly affected. And looking at the effects of things, not just in the short run, but also in the long run. So what distinguishes economics in large measure, according to Hazlitt, is the economist's perspective. It's a broad perspective, looking at the effects of things, not just immediate and direct, but also indirect, not just short run, but also long run. And to bring out this perspective, he goes through a series of important matters, starting with what he calls the broken window fallacy. And if you recall the reading, what that's all about is a hoodlum throws a brick through a bakery's window, shatters glass. At first, everyone is very upset and disturbed at this act of vandalism. But then perhaps some people in the crowd adopt what they think of as a more philosophical attitude, and they start speculating, well, it's true, the window is broken now, but there's a bright side to it. That will mean some extra business for the glazier. And then they think, well, maybe this isn't so bad. It does improve things for the glassmakers. If windows were never broken, how much business would glaziers have? And then they think further, now the glaziers have some additional business. What will they do as a result? Well, they'll turn around and step up their purchases. So people start seeing a chain of favorable events emanating from this act of destruction. They think there's more business, more employment among glaziers. The glaziers will spend the money that they earn generating more business for still others with more employment for those others, and on and on. And then they come to think that this little hoodlum who broke the window may after all be a public benefactor. Now, Hazlitt is at pains to point out that this sort of thinking is totally fallacious. It's very one-sided and narrow. It's overlooking the actual effects of this hoodlum's action on all the relevant groups. We shouldn't focus only on those most immediately concerned, the baker and the glazier, who he'll have to turn to replace his window. We have to step back and realize that the baker has an alternative use for the money that he'll now have to spend in replacing his window. I forget what dollar amount Hazlitt uses this edition. How much? $250 for the window. Well, maybe now it's $1,000, I don't know. All right, in any case, it'll cost him some amount of money to replace the window. But if he hadn't replaced the window, would that mean he would just have kept that money in a hoard and not done anything with it? And Hazlitt argues almost certainly not. And he imagines that the baker would have used this sum perhaps to buy a new suit, certainly to do something with it. So now, if the hoodlum had not broken the window, the baker would have had $250 that he would have had available to buy a new suit. But now, because the window is broken and replacing the window has to take priority over buying a new suit, he doesn't buy the new suit, he buys the replacement window. So this is good for the business of the glazier, but what is the effect on the business of the tailor, who would have had business had the window not been broken, but now doesn't? Well, he's the missing party. He's the unseen party. And Hazlitt makes a distinction between the seen and the unseen. And this goes back actually to another earlier economist, a brilliant French economist named Frederick Bastiat, who wrote in the middle of the 19th century, and he wrote an essay called The Seen and the Unseen, and Hazlitt acknowledges his debt to Bastiat, and we actually have a little reading from Bastiat at some point in the term. And Bastiat stressed that we need to see, we need to use our mind's eye to see what is not perceptually present. We don't see the tailor whose business doesn't take place because it's transferred to the glazier, but he has to be as much a part of economic analysis as the glazier who is seen. We see the glazier, that's where the spending has to occur. But what we don't see is the spending that would have occurred that now doesn't because the broken window takes priority over the new suit. Yes, and you are?
Dave Rosenthal.
Dave Rosenthal, yeah.
Help me understand that. It seems to me that the concept is that we don't consider the alternative what could have been done with that money, mm-hmm. right, or where that money could have gone.
Right.
But the big picture is that regardless of which path occurs,
yeah.
the broken window or no broken window,
yeah.
in theory, that $250 is going to be spent anyway.
Yes, it will be spent.
It balances out, does it not?
Well, there is a balance, yes. And you are.
Okay. My name is Bob Lewis. Sorry.
Bob, what?
You don't have a balance because the shop owners lost $250 when the window was broken instead of keeping the window and spending $250.
No, but go one step further. The person, the glazier, is going to make that $250
mm-hmm.
on one side,
right.
and on the other side, the tailor is going to make the $250.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That money is still being spent.
Yeah.
But
the base is
right. But so, what? The balance is out.
Well,
the tailor has one left.
No, you have one.
You would have had both the windows and the suit.
No.
Okay.
Now, if you continue that argument on even further,
mm-hmm.
presume the baker or the 100,000 bakers all have their money. What are they going to do with that money? They're going to hopefully invest that money. And in the long run, although the glazier losing in the short term $250, hopefully you will, the economy is going to be invested. It's going to be new growth and new building, and you'll get that money back from new growth instead of replacing the old building.
I just follow that. Well, I think it's a good lead into the next chapter, which is the blessing of the strike. The war doesn't create any, you're losing, you're not gaining.
Right.
This I can see in the scheme of things, the bigger picture of the loss, as opposed to gain. Yeah, it might stimulate the economy because it stimulates production, but in the long run, you're losing, not gaining. I think the same concept.
Yeah, but the hazard point is the spending will work out the same either way. The spending could go to the tailor, or alternatively, it goes to the glazier.
Right.
So the spending aspect is going to be the same, but what's different is that had it gone to the tailor, had the hoodlum not broken the window, the baker would have had his window and the new suit. This way he has just the window. The net loss is the new suit.
I guess it really matters whose perspective you're looking at it from.
Well,
I see where you're coming from because if you're looking at it from the window glazing perspective,
uh-huh.
he's only breaking, he's not breaking any window. Versus, who would have broken that window? He would have whatever business he had plus that new window broken.
He's in the business.
Correct. But if you're looking at it from his perspective, then,
correct.
I probably did.
Yes?
My
name's
Mark Mendes.
Yeah.
What about the insurance company?
Yeah.
What about the insurance company? What are we insurance going to do if they have to recover it from the back of the lock building? Isn't that similar to county law as well?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't the insurance company, similar to county, the people involved in that is huge industry.
Yeah.
The insurance alone, and some obviously insurance out the window.
Yeah.
And basically making the lock less to the baker.
Yeah,
sure. Spreading amongst the other people.
Yeah, but what about the other people whose premiums go up?
Yes. Your name?
A little further.
Your name?
Andrew Morocco.
Yeah.
You said a little further too. I had this vision when I read it about the brick going through the window and landing in his bread.
Yeah.
And that's all we've got to take a look, and that's where he's going to have to make up for it by making more bread, which is going to, he probably projected or forecasted what he needs for that particular day, and now he's going to have to alter his forecast. Well, that makes sense.
Throw away
a batch of bread, you have to make more dough for the bread.
Okay.
So he had enough flour for that particular bread that was in the window, but now he needs more flour, so he has to go into his surplus.
Okay, look at it this way. Yes, I'm sorry. That's okay.
All points are well taken. However, I think here from an economic economist.
And what is your name?
Calvin Chung.
Yeah.
Is that there is an economic value versus an accounting value. The economic value is about the society as a whole, and then the accounting value, what I see is the personal value, gain or loss. So from an economist standpoint, which one is more concern? Is it the society as a whole that, you know, business is generating revenue versus someone that, you know, have a saving account, you know, for $250? I mean, that saving account for $250, what that do to the economy? I mean, does it help the economy for the $250? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
You're asking, the tailor, the baker, you're assuming, has $250 in his savings account.
Yes.
And perhaps you're imagining he wasn't planning to buy a new suit. It was just going to be left in his savings account.
Yes.
And does that help the economic system? And if he has to now withdraw it to buy the new window, what's the effect? Well, the money that's in a savings account is not an idle hoard. It's money that is lent to borrowers. And if people have to eat into their savings, that means there's less money available to be lent. So instead of it being the case that the baker can't buy a new suit, it's someone who wanted to borrow money to buy a new table. He can't buy the new table because the money is unavailable to be lent to him because instead it's being used to buy the replacement window. So again, what we have is there's more production of windows, less production of something else, and instead of having the window, if it had not been broken, and the something else, we end up only with the window. There's a net loss of wealth. We're poorer than we otherwise would have been. Now, you might ask, what would happen if windows really were never broken? Suppose we could make windows that bricks wouldn't break. So they'd be indestructible. What would that do to the size of the window business? It would shrink it. Would that be bad? Imagine that you could buy your window, and as long as the building were to be there and not be redesigned, the window could be counted on to be effective. Well, that would mean we'd have to devote less labor and capital to producing windows. Is there anything else we need besides windows? Yeah. Well, we now have the labor and capital available to produce more of other things. We have all the windows we wanted, plus more of other things. But now, if we start destroying the windows, and we need more labor and capital to provide the same amount of glass, what are we doing to our ability to have things other than windows? We're diminishing it. See, what we really want to do is to accomplish each given result with the least possible labor. And we want the least amount of labor possible to have the greatest effects possible. Why? Because if we don't need labor for that purpose, we have the labor available to produce more of other things, which we certainly do need. So just ask yourself, when you buy something, would you rather buy something for less money or more money? Less. Now, is that creating a problem that you won't be spending anything? What is, to the extent that you can get certain things for less, what does that do to your ability to afford other things? You can buy that much more of other things. So to the extent we make it possible for given results to be achieved with less spending for them, there's going to be more spending for other things, and the result will be we'll have more goods overall. That's prosperity. Yes,
Okay. At the end of the day, I hear both parties say the point like, perhaps it doesn't matter if the monthly revenues have gone to the tailor, the revenues have gone to the window maker, the revenues there, no matter. But it seems, and I'm wondering if this is our principle, it seems that it's all about the greater good. Meaning that, sure, it can go either way, but the even greater, if we're looking at the greater good in terms of impact, from an economic perspective, the greater example would be to have the tailor, the purchase of a premium suit, for the tailor and have the bread maker be able to retain his window and his suit, because then that bread maker arguably is in a better position to go produce something else. Whether it's a suit, and he now looks better, he now can attract more customers to sell more things, or some other alternative that he would have bought, there's more, it seems to me there's more of an effect that that bread maker can have on the greater good, as opposed to, you know, one of the other. Does that make any sense at all?
I think so. What you need to do is generalize this. If you're interested, if you're talking about destruction, here we are, the baker's window is destroyed. By now, what would be the effect if the glazier's factory burns down? You see, if it's good, if it were good for the economy that the windows are destroyed, and you're saying, okay, well now there's a benefit to the glazier, what if we generalize this? Suppose we have destruction going on all around. Then what's the effect? Can anyone benefit? No one can benefit. Now, it might be, you see, think further. If we go back a few generations, agriculture was much, much more important in the economy than it is today, right? Now, what led to the decline in the significance of agriculture, its relative decline compared to the rest of the economy? An increased productivity. You see, we've doubled and redoubled the productivity of labor in agriculture, but are people prepared correspondingly to double and redouble the amount of food they consume? Not at all. Okay, now, at one time, people might have had to devote 80 or 90% of their budgets just to buying the food they needed to stay alive. And 80 or 90% of the spending in the economy went to buy things from farmers. But now agriculture gets more productive, the prices of farm products fall disproportionately unless agriculture gets smaller. Well, now we have a situation where we can produce all the food that everyone wants with maybe 3 or 4% of the population working in agriculture. And what's the effect of people having to spend so much less to buy their food, having to spend a much smaller fraction of their budget to buy food? They have money left over to buy all of the other things. Now, reducing the amount of money spent to buy food is the precondition of increasing the amount of money spent to buy all sorts of luxuries. And do we have any greater problem of unemployment now than in the past, relatively speaking? No, we don't. We have fewer people employed in agriculture, a larger proportion employed elsewhere. We're getting more food, and we get more of other things with the labor released from agriculture. So is this a benefit just to an isolated person here or there, or is this something that's benefited practically everybody?
Yes, and your name? My name is Steve. Would this change if the government didn't pay farmers and not the farmers? If all those farmers were out there farming, would that affect the pricing of the food?
Yeah, the question is, what would be the effect if the government didn't pay farmers not to produce, you said? Yeah, see, the government paying farm subsidies is something that's standing in the way of the full development of people getting the benefits of greater productivity in agriculture. As we get greater productivity in agriculture, we need fewer and fewer farmers. The farm subsidy program is an attempt to offset that. It hasn't attempted to offset it fully or even for the most part, but to some degree. The government wants to keep farming larger than it would be in the absence of its interference. Now, think of how the farm subsidy program works. I think in the overall scheme of things, with the incredible size of the government's budget, the farm subsidies are relatively small. I think I saw a figure like $20 billion, so that's not so great. Yes?
I was just going to think, is the purpose behind that, or is there a force, driving force behind that, such that, or so that, we're not dependent on other nations for food and otherwise supplies, or needed in case of conflict? We could ramp up quickly enough to feed the population, or something like that.
I don't think anyone even says that in the United States, but that would be an argument that they use in Japan. In Japan, they have subsidies for incredibly inefficient rice production carried on in Japan, where there's very little arable land, and they're growing rice at extremely high cost. When they could import rice from America at a fraction, and it's something that prevents them from benefiting as much as they might from their tremendous manufacturing productivity. They earn very good incomes, but to a significant degree, they have to waste those incomes in paying unnecessarily high prices for food. And they have that kind of argument. Japan has to be self-sufficient in its basic staple rice. But I don't see any really good argument for that. If the United States Navy can keep the supply lines clear, as I'm sure they could, then the Japanese could get their food much cheaper. Now, you had a question? All right. The farm subsidies, the figure is about $20 billion a year. I might be mistaken, it might be somewhat more. But whatever it is, however many billions, the government collects taxes on the order of $20 billion or whatever to pay subsidies to farmers. And what it's doing is it's buying agricultural commodities. It spends as much as is required to keep the price of agricultural commodities at certain target levels. Like the government may want wheat to be $5 a bushel instead of $4 a bushel. If it did nothing, wheat would be $4 a bushel. The government enters the market to the extent needed to drive the price up to $5 a bushel. Now, in the course of this, over the years, the government used to accumulate vast surpluses of agricultural commodities. They'd be storing them in grain elevators. They ran out of elevator space. They were storing it in caves, in the holds of mothballed ships, just buying up farm products to keep the price high enough to satisfy certain farmers. And then to deal with these surpluses, at some point we adopted the food stamp program. That's a means of giving away various surplus farm products. And then we have food for peace. We give food away around the world. And so here we are. There are farmers getting higher incomes than they otherwise would have. Some of their output is rotting or being given away for free, and the bill is footed by the American taxpayers. Now, suppose this program were abolished and the government reduced taxes to the same extent. So it'll spend however many billions less in buying up farm products and refund those billions to the American taxpayers. What would the American taxpayers do with those billions? They'd spend it too, not in buying the farm products. Everyone would have his own particular way. You might buy more shoes. Someone else would go to the movies more often. There'd be thousands of different combinations. But there'd be pretty much the same overall volume of spending. All right, what would be different? Instead of labor and capital producing farm products that rot in caves or are given away for free, there'd be labor and capital released to produce more of other things that people wish to buy. The taxpayers, instead of giving a chunk of their income to the government to spend to buy things that they, the taxpayers, have no interest in having, they keep that income and spend it in buying the things they wanted, and the labor and capital in the economy would soon produce less farm products and filter out through the rest of the system to produce more of the things that people actually wanted. So it would be a net gain. The overall spending would be the same, but the spending would be differently directed. It would go towards things that the citizens wanted. The production of what they wanted would be increased. The spending for what they didn't want would be decreased. The production of what they didn't want would be decreased. The net gain would be we'd be replacing the production of unwanted goods with the production of value goods. And I'm sorry I cut you off. And you are?
Roy.
Roy.
What you can say that also in this scenario, the price of farm products would be reduced as well. It would be an added benefit to the overall consumer.
Yeah, the price of farm products would be reduced. And the farm products would be produced by more efficient farmers. See, when you have the subsidies, in order to limit the amount the government spends, see, first their idea was they'll just buy up the farm products. But the farmers are able to expand their production very considerably, and if the government is willing to pay prices to cover all the costs and provide a competitive rate of profit, agricultural output is capable of greatly increasing. Well, what do you think the government has done to limit the amount of money it needs to spend to buy these farm surpluses? What further measures have been taken along the way to limit the amount of farm products the government needs to buy? Yeah.
There's also a friend of mine in Texas, she has quite a lot of acreage, yeah, and the government gives her a lot of money not to farm that.
Yeah, the government pays money not to farm the land. Yeah. If it costs them less that way, if they make payments so you don't use the land, then they don't have to buy the output of that land. And then they can impose quotas on what you can produce. So there are cases where you may have the land, you have the tractors, the fertilizer, everything needed to produce, but the government requires that you also have a special license to produce. They limit the amount that can be produced. And then when you impose limitations on who can produce, well, there are more efficient farmers and less efficient farmers. And the more efficient farmers get limited along with the less efficient farmers. See, if the government were not involved and the prices of farm products dropped, there are still farmers who could survive, but what farmers would they be? Would be farmers who have sufficiently low costs. The low-cost farmers would expand at the expense of the high-cost farmers. The agricultural commodities would be produced overall with greater efficiency at lower prices. Yes, this lady here, and your name is?
This is
Suppose someone is farming for personal use only. Does the government have control over that? To some degree, at least in the past, they have. There was a famous case back in the 1930s. When these programs got much larger, where a farmer was fined for feeding potatoes that he had grown to his own pigs. This is actually a case. It was illegal to grow potatoes to feed to your own hogs. Now, can anyone see any kind of perverse logic that would lead to that result? Here we are. The government doesn't want to spend too much money buying up farm surpluses, and there's a surplus of potatoes. So what is the effect of an individual farmer growing his own potatoes to feed to his own hogs? What does that do? He's not going to buy potatoes now, right? If he can grow his own and feed them to his hogs, then he doesn't have to buy potatoes, and who will have to buy them? Then the government. The government feels, we don't want to buy these potatoes. You'll have to buy them if we prohibit you from growing them. That's the twisted logic. But that's what happens. So the government ends up interfering even with production your own personal needs. Yes.
I have a question. There's many countries in the world, for example, up here, that do not bring this growth to here.
Yeah.
So instead of the government trying to suppress the production of potatoes, why didn't they put their efforts in trying to send those potatoes in lower cost from any other country and so into the international market?
Well, and what is your name? Stacy Nikolowski. Okay, Nikolova. Okay, well, the free market does do that as far as possible. If they can't produce something themselves and they want it, then they have to buy it from outside, and producers outside are ready and willing to sell it to them. But to the extent that we have these export sales, even that may not be sufficient to satisfy many of the farmers.
So it's going to become cost transition to do that.
Pardon me?
It's not going to make any sense if we're using, so the government is cheaper to pay them, the farmers, not people who do something rather than march to an exporter.
Well, now, the government sometimes gets involved in financing exports, and this is where the issue of dumping comes in. Here we are, a government may accumulate surpluses, and then it wants to get rid of it, and it will get rid of it at a very low price in the world market. And I think we've had cases where our government has done this. Maybe it sells cotton surpluses abroad, and then there are foreign manufacturers who get their cotton at an artificially low price, courtesy of the U.S. government, and then they produce cotton products that come back into the United States, and American producers can't compete with that. So that happens. Now, if the government were not involved, then each item would be sold anywhere in the world where there are buyers for it, and the price would be determined by the laws of demand and supply. Yes. You are again?
Jane Hardy.
All right, okay.
Does the government have the authority to dictate what to grow farm and what to produce?
No, they don't normally have that authority. Where the government gets the authority, it can tell you not to produce certain things. Like, you cannot, on your own decision, grow tobacco. You need a license to grow tobacco. I imagine there are certain other crops too. If the government is anxious to limit the overall production,
sugar.
Okay, there are quotas on sugar. You see, domestically produced sugar sells at a vastly higher price than imported sugar. I think you can import sugar at about 8 cents a pound or something like that. What is the price of domestic sugar? Much, much higher. Maybe 37 or even higher than that. Now, if they're setting a price that's really far up and would surpass costs by a big margin, well, then that would be something lots of people would love to produce. And then the government would have to buy it all. Well, to limit how much they're going to spend, they limit how much you can produce. They impose licenses.
So
isn't
that really an indirect way of controlling what you're talking about?
Well, it's controlling it to the extent that they say you can't grow this, that, or the other thing, but they're not doing that with everything, and with the things they're not limiting, you could grow whatever you want among everything else. Now, where the government gets involved in telling people what they have to produce specifically, saying you must produce this, that, or the other thing, is in a situation in which there are shortages. Fortunately, we don't have much personal experience, unless you're quite on in years, as I am, with shortages, but I see some people here who are old enough to remember the oil shortage and the gasoline shortage. Now, back in those days, this was in the mid and late 70s, you had people driving around in their cars looking for a gas station with gas to sell them. And you just couldn't find the gas. and there were shortages of oil, of crude oil too. See, we don't have a shortage of crude oil. We have a scarcity of crude oil today, but there's not a shortage because the price that's allowed to get up to $48 a barrel, that operates to limit the quantity demanded, so it keeps the quantity demanded within the limit of the supply available, however limited that might be. But when the government imposes price controls, where it says the price is not allowed to be above some definite amount, like imagine the government had said, we prohibit anyone from paying more than $30 a barrel for oil. We prohibit anyone from paying more for gasoline and corresponds to a price of $30 a barrel for oil. And at these artificially low controlled prices, people want to buy more than is available, well then you have a shortage. And when you have a shortage, anyone who could get more of a supply onto the market can sell it instantaneously. Just think, if you were a gas station owner and people are going crazy trying to find gas, if you got a bigger shipment, would you have any problem disposing of it? That would be snapped up immediately. Well, now imagine that we have a situation, there's a shortage of gasoline, there's also a shortage of heating oil, there's a shortage of diesel fuel, propane, jet fuel, one thing or another, all the different petroleum products. Now, in this situation, if anyone can produce more of anything, it'll immediately be snapped up. So if the refineries turn out more diesel fuel, no problem disposing of it. If alternatively they turn out more gasoline, no problem disposing of that. But in these circumstances, it becomes possible that you produce more of one thing at the expense of less of something else that's vitally important. Suppose we're producing enough gasoline so that people can do pretty much all the driving they want, but to do it, we're using crude oil that's not available to produce heating oil. And now people have to freeze because they'll be in order to have enough gasoline. Well, this is a chaotic situation. Now, in this environment, where price controls and shortages have created chaos, where they make it possible for the production of anything to expand to the production of anything else that may be more important, in those circumstances, the government steps in and would tell the refineries, did tell the refineries, you must produce so much heating oil, so much gasoline. Then the government takes control over what specifically is produced.
Do they get fined for not
if you violate the quotas, then there'd be various things that could happen, and I'm sure fines would be among them. Yes, and you are.
If you speak of price fixing by the government, it's what about price fixing by the manufacturers?
Okay, tell me again your name.
Bob Weatherford.
Weatherford, okay. What about price fixing by manufacturers?
Let's stay right with the oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
People quote supply and demand.
Yeah.
It's the reason that gas prices fluctuate the way that they do.
Yeah.
In addition to the price of oil. What I'm thinking of is more along the lines of, let's say Chevron has a fire in a refinery in Park.
Yeah.
You would expect that because they have increased or decreased supply, the price is going to go up.
However,
on the other hand, at the exact same time, Arco, Texaco, all the other companies are going to increase their prices.
Yeah.
Now you have an oligopoly working together, essentially price fixing, whether they talk to each other or not.
No.
It's going to affect the supply.
Okay, a couple of points. On the concrete, let's say you have a reduced supply anywhere. Well, you'd expect the price of the whole supply to be higher. You wouldn't expect that if Chevron has a reduction in supply, that means that the industry as a whole has an equal reduction, a lesser percentage reduction, but it has the reduction, and the industry price should rise commensurate with the reduction in the industry supply. So if normally, let's say, there'd be a million barrels a day coming from these companies in some area, and now a fire at one of them reduces the overall supply to 750,000 barrels, well, then we'd expect the price would be higher for all of them. If Chevron is hurt, that will improve the business of ExxonMobil and Texaco or whoever. That should be expected. Now, it's very unlikely, and I know you read in the newspapers, they try to blame the spikes in power prices on oligopolistic collusion and so on. Let's take this kind of example. Do you think it would likely be to the self-interest of Chevron that its supply falls, that raises the price well enough, but Chevron has substantially less to sell? Now, who is going to benefit from that? Chevron or Chevron's competitors? Chevron's competitors. And not just theoretically, actually. Now, the only way that Chevron might benefit, it's not impossible that Chevron could benefit, but it would be necessary for Chevron to have some kind of collusive arrangement with the others to get part of the proceeds back. See, if all that's happening is Chevron's production is cut, that improves the business of its competitors, it's unlikely to improve it unless the situation was so extreme. Let's think in terms of numbers. Let's say Chevron accounts for one quarter of the output in the market concerns. Now, if we're going to reduce the overall total supply by 10%, and that were to be accomplished by Chevron, how much of its output would Chevron have to cut out?
Much more.
They would have to reduce their output by 40%. If they're only accounting for a fourth, 40% of a fourth is 10% of the total. Now, it might be that a 10% rise, a 10% fall in supply has a significant effect on the price. Maybe it raises the price 30%. Well, if you have to cut your supply 40%, even though 10% overall raises the price 30%, if your supply is down 40% and the price goes up 30%, does that help you? You are behind. You would need a more extreme rise. But even then, let's suppose that Chevron cutting its output 40% would raise the price 50%. So Chevron could sell 0.6, well, even 1.5 would not be enough. Let's say they could it could double the price. So they'd sell 60% of their output at double the price. Now that would seem good for them, but at the same time, it's a lot better for its competitors. And do you think that any company is going to do something that will benefit its competitors so much more powerfully than it? I don't think so. Because then it puts its competitors in a position they can save and reinvest, get more efficient. So I don't think that's too likely a scenario.
I don't think that Chevron is going to intentionally hurt itself in order to create a situation.
Yeah.
But it's simply going to, but Chevron and the remainder of the industry are going to do everything they can to take advantage of.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Here lies the collusion. Okay, for instance, you know, Chevron, whoever, has that fire.
Yeah.
Instantly, the price of gas goes up, you know, what did it go up about a year and a half ago? 50 cents a year, you know.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, all because of one event that was relatively short term.
Yeah.
And yet that price did not fall again until well after the supply. As a matter of fact, if you look at it historically, there was a ratio of price of the cost of a barrel of oil related to the price of a gallon of gasoline,
yeah.
And it was way out of whack in comparison to the historical.
Well, then there must have been some special thing to account for it if their supply was in fact increasing. You know, it's also a phenomenon in the oil industry. If their inventories get too high, then you have price wars among the service stations, and you get incredibly low prices. They're trying to put the inventory in your tanks instead of in theirs. I think we're going to have to pause here. We can certainly continue following the break, but let's pause and take a break at this point.